Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
This is Tim Reedy and Carrie Weber. We're sitting in. Father Matt Malone can't be with us this week, but we are talking with Dr. Paul Gaverlook about the Holy and Great Council, which took place just at the end of June. First gathering of Orthodox churches in over 1,000 years. Dr. Gaverlook, maybe you can just explain to our readers, you know, one of the challenges here is that you do not have a pope to convene a council. There's not one person who can play that role. But that said, who are kind of the leading, you know, the most influential leaders in the Orthodox Church?
Yes, it's true that we do not have a papal figure. And so the church, and therefore the supreme authority within the church is the General Council itself. And of course, that's, you know, on the one hand, that's a weakness in terms of organization. And I think this particular council has also demonstrated the sheer difficulty of actually meeting together. But on the other hand, it is also a blessing because the structure of the church is more democratic, and ultimately no one bishop can actually declare the council authoritative. That is to say, the authority of the council crucially depends upon its reception by the people of God. So there is a kind of an intrinsic democratic principle that is built, if you will, into the structure of Orthodox conciliarity. The most significant figures at the council were Patriarch Bartholomew, who is the first among equals in the Orthodox world. And so his position essentially means that he has the historic primacy by virtue, again, of his participation in the Council of the Bishops. So his primacy is quite different in this regard from that of the Pope. You also had two very significant leaders that certainly showed a tremendous concern for the Church's mission. And that is the Archbishop Chrysostom of Cyprus and Anastasios, and Archbishop Anastasios of Albania. And so both of them have been the voices of renewal, have been the voices certainly speaking very vocally and strongly for the ecumenical continuation of the ecumenical dialogue, and in many ways have been very influential at the council. And so notice that in both cases, the sizes of their churches are quite small, but their presence was, and of their delegations was significant. As a kind of a stabilizing figure, as a centrist, I would mention the figure of Patriarch Daniel of Romania, who has been a very strong supporter of conciliarism and conciliar process, and it was in many ways his initiative to hold such councils 7 to 10 years from now, and perhaps to hold them periodically within the period of a decade or so. It was his initiative that was supported by the Council Fathers, and that actually went into one of the documents of the Council, which is the encyclical. And then the final figure, I guess, that I would mention, and that would be a person in many ways representing the position of the conservative and the more traditionalist front of the Church, and that is Archbishop Hieronymus of Athens. Now, this said, of course, there are both progressive and traditionalist elements within each autocephalous church.
Now, before the council began, some of the Orthodox churches actually chose not to attend after, you know, 50 years of buildup, 1,000 years of buildup. What is some of the reasoning around that? And does that affect how the legacy of this council or the willingness of everyone to kind of come together in the wake of it?
Well, yes. Well, there's no question that the kind of the drama of four churches pulling out 2 weeks and even less than 2 weeks before the beginning of the council has has sort of hung as a somewhat of a dark cloud over the council itself. And I should say that the prevailing atmosphere at the council was that of regret, and that is to say, they had serious issues that they needed to resolve. The best vehicle for resolving them would have been the council itself. So the first to pull out was the Church of Bulgaria, and that happened on June the 1st. And then the second church was the Patriarchate of Antioch. And the position of the Patriarchate of Antioch and the fact that the Patriarchate of Antioch decided not to attend the council, that was not entirely unforeseen. And this has to do with the fact that there is presently a break in the Eucharistic communion between the Patriarchate of Jerusalem and the Patriarchate of Antioch. The principal issue there is the dispute over the canonical territory in Qatar. And so Jerusalem claims Qatar as its canonical territory, and then Antioch claims it as its canonical territory. And at this point, there is a kind of a stalemate over this very issue. Then also, of course, there was the Church of Georgia. Finally, the last church to pull out was the Russian Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchate. And that was... again, a very, very unpleasant surprise for all. I distinctly remember the moment when we received the news that that was the case. The Church of Serbia at one point hesitated whether to attend or not to attend the council, and ultimately decided that it would attend, and that was a kind of a joyous moment. So you can see that the unity that one could speak of at this point is, if you will, tested unity and wounded unity, and it is global conciliar level, it's a unity that remains imperfect. This said, with the exception, again, of the situation between Jerusalem and Antioch, the rest of the churches, of course, do share Eucharistic communion between each other. So they are indeed in communion.
Sure. And will the documents that were approved at the council and that were discussed there still sort of affect the churches that didn't attend? Are they all sort of required to adopt some of these measures or these ideas? Or are they still up for discussion? How does that work?
Yes. So as I said, the process of reception is going to be really crucial in terms of the adoption of the documents. Now, the interesting part is, of course, is that these documents, as I said, have been discussed for quite some time. For example, in the case of the document on ecumenism, a version of it has been in circulation since actually 1980s. Now, the version that was ultimately ratified by the council was a version that was rather significantly changed in the past 10 years. But all of the churches have actually participated in the process of producing the drafts of those documents. So I think one distinguishing feature of this council is, because we're in the internet age, one could say that the reception of the documents, actually, or the drafts of the documents, began before the council itself met. What I mean by this is that they were released into the public domain in early February of 2016, and so there was this 3 months period of the discussion of the documents. And for some churches, the documents were insufficiently conservative. For other churches, they were insufficiently progressive.
Well, I think the analogy you use of family is really apt here, because it's like a Thanksgiving dinner where you're hoping, all the relatives will come around the table, but there is a sense of regret if somebody chooses not to come. I wonder what the, we've got a few minutes left here, the ramifications are for the Catholic Church. I mean, there were some representatives of the Catholic Church at the event. The question of conciliarity is one that came up a lot at the most recent Synod of Bishops, and how that's working itself out under the pontificate of Francis. And Francis himself seems very interested in moving along the conversations between the Orthodox and the Catholic Churches. Maybe you can speak about where things stand now on that front.
Yes, so Cardinal Kurt Koch and also Bishop Brian Farrell were two official representatives, and they, of course, are both the president and secretary of the Pontifical Council for Promotion of Christian Unity. So they were present at the opening and at the closing sessions of the council. I certainly think that the council is very hopeful for the ecumenical relations, for the Catholic Orthodox relations, in the sense that while there were some hierarchs and some churches that were suggesting that non-Orthodox churches do not even merit the designation of the church, that position was essentially refuted at the council. That position did not prevail. So I would say that a kind of a staunchly anti-ecumenical line certainly did not prevail. And that there was the fundamental commitment to the ecumenical dialogue and to seeking Christian unity, and most especially seeking unity with the Catholics, was certainly reaffirmed. The interesting part, I suppose, is that in paragraph 12 of the document on the relations of the Orthodox with the rest of the Christian world, which is a kind of, it's a kind of an analog of Unitatis Redintegratio, or the document on ecumenism of the Second Vatican Council. The document in paragraph 12 speaks of the hierarchical ordering of challenges, that's to say, that pertain to each bilateral dialogue. The dialogue was different non-Orthodox churches, and so that's similar to the language of the hierarchy of truths. So what Vatican II expresses positively in terms of the hierarchy of truths and differences between different churches, in this case, is expressed positively. And the point here is that not all the differences are on the same level. Not all church dividing issues are of the same gravity. And I think that's a significant, that represents a step forward, the recognition of that at least.
Well, thank you so much. Now, if our readers want to learn more about this, they can read Dr. Gavrilik's articles on americamagazine.org. Dr. Gavrilik, one quick, very brief question. We have a minute left. What personally did you find fulfilling having been a part of this process?
Listen, I teach ecumenical councils, and I teach the historic councils of the church. And so it's interesting to theoretically have some theoretical idea about them, but I think my teaching will never be the same after this experience. So I would say that it's the experience that mattered, because it's one thing to theorize about conciliarity. It's quite different to actually see it in action. And that's what I found most inspiring.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you so much for sharing this information with us, for sharing your experience with us. We really appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be talking with our new national correspondent, Michael O'Loughlin, who has recently come into our offices here in New York, and we are graced with his presence, and we're excited to talk with him a bit about what he's going to be working on and what he's already been working on at americamagazine.org. We'll take a break, and we'll be back in a minute.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.